Well, hi everybody. How are you today? This is Mark Chaffardini. Thank you very much for coming back to the Go See Talk podcast experience. We are thrilled and delighted to bring our next guest on the show, cinematographer, producer, director Joe Hill, to talk about Match in a Haystack. But before we get to that, I want to ask you, are you okay? How you doing? How's your family? We always want to make sure that you're doing well, people you love are taken care of, as this film definitely gets into that. It's about personal well-being and the general goodwill of humanity in a way. So a lot of big picture stories happening in this one beautiful documentary. But before we get into all that, Joe, thank you so much for your time and coming on the show. How are things in your world?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Things in my world are it's good. Honestly, I'm back in Los Angeles. I'm home, and so is my fiance, which is abnormal because usually she's traveling around. She's a dancer in the national tour of Moulin Rouge, and so she's always on the road. And right now, just to paint the picture, she's making a matcha wearing some kind of like weird UV mask or something in the background, just so that anyone understands the kind of world that I live in.
We all strive to understand ourselves, but it's even tougher to understand the people we live with.
It's tougher.
Yeah. Well, I would say c'est magnifique if you're talking about Moulin Rouge. Well, I'd say that's a great dance card to have, literally dancing for that. Amazing.
Yeah, she's always very impressive, honestly. She's been in a lot of these different shows, and it's very fun to see her, but it's also nice to be in the same place. I think that that's and this is something that we've had a lot of not This is something that we've had to build through, we've gone through as a couple for a long time, because before she was on the road, I was on the road traveling with Vice News, where I used to work. And so I'd always be traveling for work and making these documentaries, and then she'd be back. And so it's amazing we've like managed to survive so many years with like on and off long distance.
Well, when is the big day? Have you guys set that?
Yeah, we're talking, I can tell you next year is our ambition.
Okay. Throwing it out there, throwing it way out. That sounds good.
The most nebulous. Yeah, I was gonna say, like, it's I'm sort of have a trend. I don't know how this happened to me, but for a long time, like, I'm sort of the kind of person who buys a ticket one way. It's like I buy the flight one way and I'm like assuming that I'll come back, but I just don't know when, and it doesn't make sense to try to plan so far in advance. You never know what's gonna happen, and so I think that this is something that's plagued our wedding planning.
You sound very much like myself. I'm a wing it type person, very opposite of my wife, who has to have everything scheduled. I'm like, hey, there's no freedom that way. Let's just have fun. But good luck to you both. But why don't we get to know Joe Hill? Let's climb up that mountain that is your career, your cinematography. What were some of the first things that got you interested in moving pictures, and what made you so amped to try this for yourself?
That's a great question. I think, the truth is that my entry point was theater before film. And to be really honest, I was homeschooled when I was young, and I was raised in kind of an untraditional family. And the first thing that I did way before I went to public school, or before honestly, before I could learn how to read, I was in this community theater. And so I would act in these plays, and I couldn't read the scripts, but I could memorize the lines, and I could sort of like learn to. I was learning, I think, the way to interact with the world through story. And I think that was the same kind of way that my family would interact. Like I didn't always have, I think my parents and I had great relationship, but not always like a very open dialogue. But we could sit on the couch and we could watch something together, and see these other characters go through this thing that was a meaningful experience, and suddenly, like, they experienced something that was meaningful, or they had some kind of catharsis, and like that gave my me the language or the words to be able to talk about these things that I was feeling. So I think that, like, it's fundamental to me. It's like that I've never really understood the world through a different way. And I went I thought I wanted to do theater, I thought I wanted to act, and I realized, pretty quickly, that I kind of didn't want to do that. I wanted to like be making something. I wanted I liked the act of making things, and with a group of people getting to make something. And I started to make theater with, like a little group of scrappy, basically we're like a very DIY kind of like high school kids making very angsty theater. And we did a few shows, and I kind of it made me feel empowered, like I was able to just make things. But it was college, I was really excited about. film. And I was really excited about the fact that more people could see that, and that you could do something that I am compelled by something ephemeral, but I also, it's so cool that something could exist forever, that you create this record, this thing that exists like long beyond us. And so I started doing these, essentially I started making these like little docs, because it was a lot easier to make documentary to me. And honestly, because I wanted to be interacting with the world around me instead of just like with other artists in a room or something. And so it was kind of, I can't explain why this happened, but it just really like opened this whole world to me. Suddenly I was getting to travel for the first time, and I was getting to meet people who were different than me and make these meaningful relationships. And so like I really just landed in this world of documentary.
Well, what were some of the first documentaries or cultures, countries that really cemented the desire to keep doing it?
Well, so my parents had never left the country, and I didn't have a passport until I was in college. And so we didn't have this global perspective. And then when I was in college, I got this opportunity to make these short documentaries about a school in South India. And it was like, it was so far beyond the realm of what I had experienced. And that was, I remember landing in this airport in a town called Chennai, which is in the very south. I basically just like landed and got off the plane, and like the air was thick. It smelled different. It was like there was a feeling I'd never had in my life. And so I remember we drove in a taxi, and I was looking out the window, and I saw, places with all these, chicken dangling in the windows, and all, it's like such a culture shock for me, and so exciting and so sort of exhilarating. And then the work was really meaningful. I liked the organization that asked us, and they kept on bringing us back. And I was still in college, so it was like cheeky, like pretending to like we run a production company, saying like, okay, and in between, in this month we have a week off for Thanksgiving, so it's like let's just pretend like that's like the window that we have available, so we could fly to Ethiopia for that week or something, and then we'd like shoot this doc and come back. So it's very, we were really just like trying to get these opportunities to happen. And I think it was just, we were college kids that were willing to do things that were much harder and much less money than most people. But there was this really significant change where I'd sort of just been doing these kind of freelance jobs. I'd been just shooting these little videos for people, and I felt this sense that like, maybe it was possible that, I don't know, I felt the sense that like there were stories that felt compelling to me. Like there were these things that I wanted to talk about, and there were situations. I met specifically a guy named Luis, who was he's a Venezuelan refugee, and I met him in Chile. And I was studying abroad there, so I was still in college. And we became really good friends, and he told me all about Venezuela. Like he really got me excited and interested, and it made me care about this place that I didn't know anything about until I like got to learn about his life. And this was going into 2017. And so in that year, for people who don't know this, like Venezuela basically erupted into these protests, and there were all of these people sort of fighting to try to oust the president, Nicolas Maduro. And it looked like civil war was about to start. There were pro you know the police had fired live rounds into the crowd, and all these people had died. It was a very intense sort of moment. And Luis called me and was like, dude, like I don't, I mean, I just feel like wrong that I'm not in my country. Like, how could I like have left? And it feels like there's something happening. I have to be a part of it, and I have to go back. And, I want to show the world that Venezuela is a place that's worth fighting for, that it's actually beautiful, and like that's why we care and why it's not worth like just abandoning. And so he was like, I want to go back, and I want to climb the tallest mountain of Venezuela. And I was like, that sounds like a movie, man. That sounds kind of pretty nuts. And he was like, yeah, like I'm gonna do it. And I was like, then I'm gonna film you doing that. I mean, I wanna go. Like I'm doing that. And so we kind of like, I figured out a way to get a visa to Venezuela, which is very difficult for a US citizen at that time. And we sort of, as there were literally millions of people fleeing Venezuela, like becoming refugees and walking essentially across the border into Colombia. And we walked up the river of people going the other direction into Venezuela. And we stayed there for, so I think probably 6 weeks. We just were in the country filming this doc about trying to climb the tallest mountain. And I think that this was a huge turning point for me, because it was, the same sort of DIY, like, you can just make something yourself. It was just me and a camera. There was, we had no money. I was sleeping. I got fleas, I think, at one point, and definitely a parasite. And it was like all the sort of, it was a challenging shoot. And at the same time, it was the first time that I was like, this is the most meaningful. Like, this is the kind of story that I care about. And it matters so much to me that I like feel so connected to the people that I get to learn from here. And so I think that this really like catalyzed this sense of like make, that you can make stories that are for the sake of themselves instead of like for the sort of marketing potential of what they are, I guess. That was like a huge shift for me.
I love the idea of you helping support somebody's vision, and you enhance your own worldview. You do learn different things about cultures and mindsets. But I think it's rather beautiful that you're able to facilitate this. But I always wonder about how a documentary really is structured, because it sounds like opportunities you've gotten in life have been pitches, and a lot of times a documentarian will kind of like let things unfold in front of them, but there's still a bit of staging. Like, he has a goal. He wants to go up the mountain. So how do you dance that card between, I know what we want, but we're still gonna sit back and kind of let it happen?
Yeah, that, I mean, then that's honestly, this is a really fun conversation for me because it's like, this is what we debate all the time, I think. Like, me and my journalist friends are like, we always have this conversation about, how much does how much does our presence affect and change the story that's unfolding, and how much, can we influence and change the dynamics of what's happening? Are we producing something into happening by, like, sort of suggesting, there's all these questions that sort of like really ride this fine line. And it's ethics, and it's like, I think it's case by case. It's like, I wish that there was some kind of blanket rule, but I think that you have to make these decisions just based on your values. You have, I think that over time you acquire a certain set of values of what you believe in as a person and what you believe in as a filmmaker and as a journalist. And those things just help to guide you to make better decisions about what is okay and not. In for me, my feeling is that a story is a story, whether it's a documentary or not. And you have to find, there's like these fundamental building blocks that I think you have to identify. You have to know, what is, you have to have a character. And in this case, it's a real person, and it's someone that you have a relationship with, and it's someone that you care about. And that's important. It's like, you're, I would say that, this goes back to your ethics. It's like, as a storyteller, it has to be a character who's compelling and whatever. But like, as Joe, I want to, there's someone that I care about. I'm not gonna like, I value this person over the story. And that's like a rule for me. That's my values. So this, you have a character and you have a strong desire or an objective. There's something that they want. And I think that you have to, the more clearly you can express what they want. I want to climb the tallest mountain of Venezuela. I want to make a play in Ukraine, which, I know we're going to talk about soon. Or I want to, I'm traveling across Colombia to find to claim the remains of our father who was killed by the FARC, and now we're going to give him a proper burial. Or like, there's an objective and there's a clear obstacle, there's something that stands in the way, and there's all the things that these people are willing to do to overcome that, and what's at stake if they succeed, and what's at stake if they don't succeed, and what it matters. It's like, these are like, when I'm talking about this, it's like, I feel like these are just like the basic building blocks of story. But I think that, you're not, for you to identify these and ask for them and seek them out as you're making a film is like, I don't think that that has anything to do with influencing the story. I think that it's just like your due diligence. You have to identify them. You have to find a way to articulate them so that the story is able to function and an audience understands why it matters.
Sure.
Does that make sense? I mean,
Oh,
I'm.
it totally does. And like you said, it's different. It's case by case. But I imagine myself as like, if I was just told, as I was now, that somebody wants to go somewhere, right? So you almost think of it in framing construction. Do you beat them to the top and watch them come up the mountain? Are you following behind so that they're the first ones to actually reach their goal? Like, is it Rocky, where you're in tandem going up the stairs, like Garrett Brown with the Steadicam? Like, and these, I mean, sure, those are all, ways to make it more impacting. It doesn't detract from the overall goal. But I mean, I could just imagine that there's these different things happening in your head as to logistics, because you are telling something in a visual narrative, and just a big swirl of like, how do we do this?
I mean, this is a different, I was gonna say, like, just getting into the nitty-gritty, the scenes, like, this is when I think, I mean, you're right, it's like, this is the challenge. And I think I've done it multiple ways. I shot a film in the Arctic recently that was, it's a film about the time polar night, which is like essentially for, during the winter, the Earth tilts away from the sun, and the very northernmost part of the country of the world is in a shadow that's cast by like the thicker parts of the world. And so for 5 months, these people live in darkness. And so this film, like, is very poetic sort of view of light and darkness and what that means in our lives. And so there's like these slower moments of of reflection and like the sensation, trying to articulate the sensation of light and what light really means for you, and also what darkness can reveal. And it's like, so this film I think was nice. We really took our time. I mean, the DP is amazing, and he really like took his time. They'd spend days just trying to get a couple shots of B-roll of like the sun peeking up over the crest of a mountain or whatever it might be. Versus the film that I'm making, that we just are releasing right now in Ukraine, Match in a Haystack. This film is about a group of artists. They're a group of dancers in Ukraine, and when Russia invaded, they sort of like, who they used to be just like completely ceased to exist. They were suddenly, they're suddenly just, art was meaningless. There's no chance of art. It doesn't exist. And you either go to the front lines and fight, or you flee the country, or you volunteer and try to like send supplies to the front lines, or so, something. And then it occurred to them that, if Russia, maybe Russia didn't annex the lands. Like, maybe it's true that they hadn't succeeded in taking over the country, but they had successfully stopped contemporary Ukrainian culture from existing. And so suddenly that this became the issue. And so the film for us was like about this real time, again, going back to structure, we knew that there was a clear goal. They wanted to make a performance. They decided that they'd just make art during war. So we had maybe some structure to try to put the film within, but we really wanted it to feel just immersive. Like, it was really intimate, immersive. You were just with the main characters of the story. It was really intimate. It was basically just spending time with them and understanding that, like, whether they make the play or not, you just have to understand what it means to them. Like, why does it matter so much? It's just a play, but it matters more in this case. And so, like, I think that in this case, there was no sort of do-overs. We were just two cameras, handheld, flying. There are scenes where the footage is amazing. I'm like so proud of how it looks, despite the fact that we were shooting this way. And there are scenes where it's like the light is, it's pretty tough. It's like, or like it's basically shooting in pitch black, like, the back of a theater or something. I think that that feeling, it works in a different way. I think that it makes it feel like it was, as opposed to sort of like the pinnacle of what it could be or something,
Oh, totally. And I think that's one of the things that's the most captivating about it. It is real time. It is, people's emotions and how they're reacting to the situations. And literally any day could be different. I mean, there are so many variables. But if you think about it in terms of, safety, you can think about it in terms of what you're wanting to capture. And I love what you said, because I was thinking that too. It's less about, to quote the great philosopher Tyler, life's a journey, not a destination. So it's like whether they get, whether it's a rousing applause or they actually finish the dance, it's just about how they're able to, it gets them out of their own situation, which is, just a t terrible place to be in. And I think too, there's so many things that, I mean, I was watching this, I took over 60 screenshots. I mean, I think that the things that the girls have said, I mean, you could write, I mean, that's on par with what you'd see in a narrative film. And I mean, just the things that they came up with. And even it seemed like Yulia came up with the title of the film, Match in a Haystack. It was like, I'm watching poetry right here amidst, very dire circumstances. So I guess the girls were safe as they could be, you and your team. But I guess what was that feeling like? What was the was it as tense as it seemed on screen?
Let me say this. I think that what's interesting about the film for me, and I didn't expect this going into it, I think I thought when I had pitched this film, like, let's make a film about a group of artists. What does it mean to create during a time of war? What if we made a film about the creation as opposed to destruction that takes place throughout our history in these very difficult times, you know? Like that's a crazy idea to begin with. And I think that we weren't looking for people who were creating. Let me say this. I think that I thought that we'd find people who were creating as like this act of defiance. They're like, well, you haven't killed me yet, so look what I can make. Or, you know, it felt like that was kind of like the idea. And I think that in that sense, it's defiance. There's a conversation, or there's sort of the antagonist of the story is these bombs that are falling. And this is sort of always the thing that people are up against. And I thought what was so compelling to me about this group of dancers, like this group of women, and what they were setting out to do, was that, you know, the bombs falling is like the obs, you know, it is the obstacle. It's obviously present. It's something that was happening. It's something that is true to the scenario. And yet, like, they had sort of transcended to this place where the conflict of the story was themselves. And the conflict of the story, the thing that they were wrestling with, had everything to do with their own sense of meaning and like purpose, and the questions of, you know, as someone whose life has been flipped upside down, or someone who used to find meaning in the things that I did, or like the things that I've created, or the people around me, like as someone who used to have these sensations that felt like different than pain, you know, like, are those things allowed to be part of my life? Am I able to, as a person now that this has happened to me, am I able to still cling to these sensations? And I think that, you know, that I would argue. You know, the war is very palpable in the film, I think. There's power cuts, and there's airstrikes, and there's a lot of these sort of elements. But I think that some of the tension that you might be picking up on, and the tension that I feel when I watch the film, has everything to do with the people themselves and the amount of importance they place on the decisions that they make. And that to me was really cool to sort of like tell a story that was the conflict.
I love what you said because it's basically the crux of the film. It's the backbone of the film, especially when is it Gala or Gala?
Gala.
Gala. When she says, "I'm not sure if I'm an artist anymore. Art is not that powerful now in these conditions. It's not the time for it. Nobody needs it now." So it's like she recognizes it won't save her country from war, but it's still, you know, holding on to who you are, you know, whether regardless of your profession, it's just something that you have to get out of you. And then a little later in the film, when was it Nadia who went to see her sister on the front lines? That was, you know, that was powerful too, because she was saying that, you know, as you were saying, you either fight or you flee, and her sister just couldn't take inaction, so she took to the front lines. And just going to see what it's like, having a discussion with her, and you know, so much to the fact people are, you know, desensitized by the air raid sounds. I mean, there's so much happening. There is no question there, but just I'm grappling on to the elements at play and how, like you said, these characters are interacting with their feelings and how it's a lot to contend with, so.
Well, and I don't want to spoil, like, you know, the scene. There's a few of these scenes, you know, that I think I want to talk about, but I'm also like afraid of spoilers. Like, I want people to watch the film and experience for the first time what Nadine experiences when she goes to the front lines. Like, I think that scene to me feels, you know, to me, it's the most important scene of the film, and I think a lot of people agree when they see it. And I think that, you know, there's these certain things that they. I guess some of the goals that we really had, and I hope is what's coming through in the film, is we knew that there was this thing that was going to happen. They were going to try to make a play, or a dance performance. We knew that that would give the story some kind of structure. We had a beginning, middle, and end. Theoretically, they would try to do this thing. They'd set out to do this thing. They'd try to do it. You know, they would either succeed or fail, and that, you know, that's about as much as we knew going into this project. And then we started to find the individuals, like who they were and what they're struggling with, and how it was so interesting to see, you know, one of the people making this performance, Gala, like, she's in rehearsals telling us that like it's bullshit. You know, she's telling us that like it doesn't make any sense, and it doesn't matter. And I think, you know, that was so surprising. And you know, Julia, sort of like the most convicted person, the person who like decides, you know, from the get-go that she says, you know, we're going to do this. The opening scene of the film is that she says, there's no way you can't take away our ability to keep creating. And then, you know, and then she waffles. Suddenly, like we watched, I saw her as things changed for her. And I think that what's really exciting to me is that it felt like, I don't know, I would say, you know, I would say that it's like essentially I wanted to somehow create this real time, like in present tense sort of storytelling where this group of people, you witness them change over the course of time. And I think the change that they actually go through is the real story of the film. And that I think was harder to structure and harder to understand and required a lot more of just under like it required a friendship where we knew each other well enough that we could talk about and try to put our finger on the thing that was changing so that we could try to convey it in the story. So there's a lot of this part I think was m very fulfilling, you know.
True, but you know, there's going a bit deeper. There's a part in the film where Yulia and Gala were talking about, you know, we need to time to focus on the girls' emotional states because you know that if it's them doing their own thing, that's one thing. But you know, they are spearheading this organization, this troop, and I think it's really cute how you see things like them messing up with the long piece of fabric and the smiles. And so it's not all doom and gloom. You know, I think everybody could have hunched shoulders waiting for literally the bomb to drop. But you know, you captured these girls in stairwells dancing, you captured them having fun. And so there is, you know, the joy in the process and the relief of the execution. And so it's not super tense and palpable. I didn't want you to think I was like on pins and needles the whole time, but there were elements that you did feel the connection, whether it was you know, healthy emotion or fear. So I think it did run the gamut, and it did present these women as you know, their own individual entities. So again, no, not a question there. It's just more of a, it is a round of applause. So
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I mean, I think something that I don't mean to segue to this, but I will maybe there something that I think is really special and something that I really enjoyed is you know, they're such complex people. They're going through so many interesting things. There's so much that they're having to navigate. And we found really quickly that, you know, it wasn't necessarily fair for us to try to just interview them. You know, okay, so these are women who express themselves through movement. It's the way that they create, it's the way that they express. And then we'd sit them in front of a camera and be like, all right, now explain to us. And we're, you know, just articulate perfectly, like, what is it that you feel? What does this mean? You know? And it was like that was kind of an insane thing to try. And it is kind of the way of documentary. I think it's often what we do. And so we knew that we had to sort of like problem solve, like think of some other ways to approach this. So we decided to do these things like these dance scenes where essentially it was like conducting an interview but through movement. And we would choose a location where they felt comfortable and we'd record with two cameras the same way that we did with all the interviews. And we would give them these sort of prompts that were similar to like the thematic things that we were trying to explore in the film or like the things we were exploring with the individual in the film. And then they would improvise, they would dance, they would do whatever they felt. Sometimes it was dance, sometimes it was not. I mean, sometimes it was swaying or it could be, you know, it could be lots of different things. But it would come out, it would manifest in movement. And these scenes, I think, you know, for me again, I think that they're the most compelling, important parts of the story because, you know, dance is kind of amazing. It's like I'm not a dancer first, so I have to preface. I'm like pretty bad at dancing and I get made fun of all the time, especially having a fiance who's a dancer, it's embarrassing. But you know, I do think that when words don't suffice, like when you can't express it through words, I think sometimes people start to sing, or it's like that's the feeling is too much. And I think that sometimes when language or when song no longer cuts it, then like the language is movement. And I think it's pretty cool to see these scenes, like essentially verite filmmaking in a war documentary, where suddenly the scene transcends, and the verite scene is just someone dancing in their stairwell. And something I promise, I mean, I think you've seen it, you can attest, I think that something is being conveyed in this dance, you know, even though it's a universal language, even though there's no subtitles in the scene, it's like something is being conveyed. And I think that this is a really cool part of the film, something that I was most excited to explore. And something that I'm really proud of us like sort of trying this like documentary tactic of using dance as a documentary technique or something.
And going back to your experiences in India for the first time, where you're seeing the world from a different perspective, I felt as a cinema goer, I'm watching something that I don't quite know, but I'm learning about. And it's simply about their dance styles. I'd never seen that type or the way the movements were kind of a bunch of small movements where the legs and arms and they were kind of snake octopus like. It was so captivating to watch because I guess growing up in the States, you see things like America's Got Talent or these things, and a dance troupe is different because that's kind of what I've seen. And just seeing a different way to do it was kind of captivating and mesmerizing. And I can sense the heightened emotional sense. I mean, even the part where Gala starts dancing in her room, it just kind of draws you in because you do feel what's happening. And there's another part in the film where they say they're accustomed to suffering, so to speak. And it's like you just don't know another person's life until you kind of walk in their shoes. And this was a really good, glimpse into that without getting, how do I say, well, not overwhelming to the sense it was heavy-handed, but just like you got right to the heart of it, so to speak. So
I think I really do like these little windows. The story you're talking about when she says they're accustomed to suffering, it's another dancer named Dasha, who is, she's the youngest of the group, and she lives in Ukraine by herself. She doesn't have her family there because her family is still in a town called Nikopol, which is way in the east of the country, and it's just being pounded. It's a place that's been pounded this entire war. So it's actually like, a lot of people wouldn't live in a place like this. There are some towns that like a lot of people just don't live. It's maybe 10% of the population that once was there is still in the city, or sometimes, and I that's a fake, it's not the number of Nikopol, I don't know the statistic, but it's just that for her to sort of be reflecting on those people in her family and to sort of like have to think through this process of like why does someone endure something like this? Like, what does it mean to like endure that? Why? And like, what does it mean for me to be free of that? Like, what does it mean for me as a person to know that my family's going through that every day and I'm not? And I think about this sort of like, there's a lot of complicated aspects of this for people, and it's more complicated than just like, am I going to be bombed today? And I think that sometimes we sort of miss these like nuances.
And I'm also curious on kind of a number of levels. You are coming in with an idea to capture something, and technically you're an outsider. You kind of share what you want. They're amenable to it. I guess how quickly were, I mean, it seems like to get the results, things had to gel pretty quickly, but can you recall back to a time where you knew that this was right, or you felt like we're finding a flow, finding a vibe? And the girls were really, on board.
I was going to say that well, I'll share with you two instances. One of them when it didn't look that
Okay.
good. We had decided that we'd make a film about this group of women. We had been talking to them about the performance they wanted to make. We were trying to the film started to try, the premise was that we'd find a performance or some kind of creation that was taking place. We'd want to document the creation process, and that was sort of, in essence, creating this record of history that was like about the act of creation as opposed to destruction in a war. And that felt really important that we'd make. But we had to find the right project, that it was something we believed in, that it might actually happen, that the people behind it were, putting meaningful thought behind what they were doing. And so we found we found Julia and we found Gala, and we wanted to make the thing. And they were like, sure, you can come and film the rehearsals. We're having our first rehearsals these days, so you can come to those. So, we traveled all the way from New York City to get to Ukraine, and it's a no-fly zone. So that means you have to fly into Poland or to Moldova. There's a couple different countries you can fly into. You have to cross the border by, this time, the first trip we drove to the border, crossed by foot. So like wheeled a cart up a
Wow.
hill, with all of our camera gear and our flak jackets and helmets and all the stuff that we had to bring. Went through by foot again, got picked up by another car, drove, 15 hours. It's like, I would just say a pretty significant amount of travel to get there. And then we had dinner with them the first night that we arrived. And at dinner, they were like, "Oh, like I thought you just want to come like one rehearsal." We're like, "Dude, like no. Like we want to make like a whole film. We want to meet your parents. Like we want to like get to know everything about, you know what I mean?" It was like this very clear dissonance in terms of what we had understood we were doing. And it was t honestly tense. Like I was, and it's not my first time feeling this way, but like where you sort of like realize that like the access that you sort of think you have to a certain story is tenuous. It's like not quite clear what you really are able to film. So we started going to rehearsals, and I think that they sort of thought we were making like a news package, this kind of, 2-minute video about like it's dance in a time of war, it's defiance, and and then it kind of has some B-roll or something. I think like this is what they thought we were doing. But we kept on showing up, we just kept on coming, and we filmed for 4 hours one day, and then the next day we filmed for 8 hours, and it's like these we're really doing it. And so it's, I think they were pretty, they didn't quite trust us at first, and it sort of took our first trip to get to know each other better and to have some time together. And then when we left, the company that I was working for, Vice News, went bankrupt. Actually, Vice, the institution, the entire company went bankrupt. And so suddenly it looked like maybe we'd never finish this movie, and like we shot half of it, but the rest of it would never come to fruition. And it's obviously very different than surviving a war, but I think for those women, they felt this sense that there was no guarantee they'd ever be able to finish the performance, or that they would survive to see the day that it would happen. And there was no guarantee that the rehearsal hall that they were rehearsing in that they booked would be intact, or whether it'd get struck, or whether the power would be out. And so it's like there's no guarantee. It's so difficult to plan. And then we were kind of in the same boat. We're like, we had no guarantee that we'd ever be able to move forward. And there was this kind of mutual thing that we were both going through. It was like that the art project that we were trying to make was just like not possible, most likely. And we were all fighting this sort of parallel fight. And I remember that when we finally got things to coalesce, some big, a lot had to happen for this to work, but we finally got to travel back to Ukraine to be there for the time that they were going to make this performance. It was so significant to be back in the same place. And it was like that we had been talking for a year, that we had, and then we were suddenly in the same place again. And it was like a profound friendship. And I didn't remember that that was the case when we had left the previous time. And so I think that this, it was so interesting to me, like the way that in a film that we had two trips, which I wish we would have had more, but it's like with two trips. And I felt like the relationship that we had with people we were filming was so dramatically different between the two trips. I feel like you can see it in the footage as you watch time evolve. But it's interesting to me, like what it took to be able to get the level of access and the kind of intimacy that I think the film ends up sort of carrying with it into the, I think that you'll be surprised watching the film at the level of intimacy and the sort of like openness that these women were willing to share with us. And I think that that came about because of this sort of commitment and time and parallel journeys we were all on.
That's excellent. Yeah, I mean, I can see that, whether you use the term short timer or outsider, you don't live here, you don't speak the language, so it is difficult for you to sort of cross that relationship bridge with all these participants. But if I heard you right, so you're only there twice. The first one was 6 weeks, and then the second trip was to capture the performance. And how long was that trip?
Oh, I was going to say the first one was only 10 days. I had 6 weeks in Venezuela,
Oh, okay.
which is probably not enough time for that movie either, but but at least we pulled it off, this was 10 days on the first trip. It was like roughly 15 days on the second trip. So
Okay.
it's a feature film shot in over the course of 25 days, a year apart. That's sort of the confines of this production. And I personally think that the film could have been better had we had more time. And it was hard for me to be in the US sort of knowing that the women were going through things that I found important that I would have liked to have seen and been involved in and been able to include. But we weren't able to because of logistics and finance. And I think we were really limited by the reality of trying to make a documentary.
Sure. Well, then I think that parallels exactly what Yulia was saying when she said the finish line is always the hardest part, but it's an ex because it's an extra exhausting sprint. But so I'm wondering, capturing it is one thing, but then putting the pieces together at the end, what's I'm sure you're up against runtime. I'm sure you're up against a lot of things that you hate to not include. So what was that assembly cut like for you?
Yeah, but the first assembly, so once we had the footage, we'd gotten back from the second trip. I think that originally when Vice commissioned the film, they thought it was going to be like a 20-minute movie, probably like a short. And it was on the first trip, it occurred to me that it could be a feature film, that like the people were really compelling to watch and they were really important. They had important things to say, and there was a lot that could be unpacked. And then on the second trip, when we went back, it was very clear that we had enough for a feature. Like I was like, and I was still having to convince people that this was the case. And so I had no more money. I didn't have any support to finish the film, like in post-production, but we did have the footage. And so I spent a month basically just like tied to my computer, and I scripted the film. I like took all the translations. Some of it was real translation. Some of it was AI translations. We were like just trying to save money, but be able to like understand the footage and be able to put it together somehow. So I took it and put it all together, wrote a script. Then I made an assembly cut, and then I edited one of the most important scenes. I edited the scene where Nadine went to visit the front lines. And so this sort of thing, it was probably like a 2.5 hour, 3 hour assembly of just all the pieces that I thought were really important in the right structure, in the right order, a bunch of footage just so you could see. And I was like, so yeah, I mean the line between this and a real movie is still vast, but at least like if someone looked at this and just even clicked through it, you could see that there's a real movie, that this will be a film. And so that was sort of like the most significant turning point, that suddenly someone could see like the scope of what I think we're setting out to make. And we started to be able to get a little bit of support. I was able to bring on an editor who's incredible, a New York editor named Arielle Sherman, who, she started from that point and was able to put it into like an entire film.
Well, is that how you stay objective? Because I think when you're shooting subjects and you've gotten to know them, still you can have your outline of who you think you want to focus on and how it all gels together. Because this is captured events. But I guess how do you stay objective? And is there a point where the girls get to see and have influence or input, or do you try to just stay hands off till the end?
It's a great question. I feel like it's different. I would maybe say it was different if it was just like a piece of journalism. When I used to work at Vice, I used to have some pretty hard lines about what I would be willing. Like I wouldn't show people rough cuts, and I wouldn't show, and especially like I try to hold people to the same standard. So like if I were to record an interview with Vladimir Putin and he were to go, "I don't like this line, you should take it out," I'd be like, "No." Like you should have said it then. If you don't like this thing, then don't say it. So and I want to be able to maintain like a similar rule. Like I think that all people should be given the same rules for what they say. But in a documentary, I was more concerned, not so much like I'm not holding anyone to account for their actions. I'm not, like I'm not, it's not a hit piece. It's like I was just trying to convey this real experience. Like I wanted to create an accurate depiction of like this very real type of experience that they understood as experts, essentially, because they're living through it versus me as I'm representing it. I'm trying to convey it. And so we made a cut that was pretty close. It's like a pretty good cut. I think people could watch it at this point. It's like a watchable movie, but the music was still temp music. We hadn't had the composer come in, and there were still some things that there were still some changes that need to get made, but it was probably about the last time that I'd be able to really like get anyone's opinion. And so Julia hosted all the women at her house, and they projected it on her wall, and they watched it.
Wow.
And I was like, I think I kind of knew in my head, it was like if they said, like I morally object to the way that you use this interview and the lighting's wrong. It's like there are things that like I would have just been like, so that's not really like the notes I'm looking for. But I think if they said, we feel that this doesn't convey what I felt, or like th there's something like this that would have been like really important feedback, and I would have wanted to really take this into account. So it's kind of like I was a little nervous about what I might hear. And so they watched the film, And I knew what time they were going to watch, and we're going to FaceTime afterwards. And then I was waiting, and it was like an hour passed, and like, a couple hours passed. And I was like, damn, like what's going on, And so they finally called me, and they're all sitting around, and they're all kind of like nodding. And it's like, so what, what did you think? You get the chance to watch the movie. And they were like, Joe, we've decided that we like it. And it's like, holy shit, like, oh, I'm so relieved, I guess. But like, that's such a stark way to even tell me like what's going on.
We've decided. The commune has spoken.
Yeah, literally. I mean, so I was kind of, obviously they were talking about it a lot, and I was like, tell me more. What's the conversation, and what are you feeling about it? And they were like, it's just so vulnerable to watch yourself in this way, like, and also to see like these things reflected back. Like it's like the way that I felt, and now I'm seeing it, And so I think that what was really cool about this feedback was that they were just like, this represents what we experienced. And, there was a couple notes. I think Nadine was like a perfectionist, and she was kind of like, hey, like my dance scenes are like a little long, you could trim them. Or like, there's like, and there was like a song that they were like, hey, like this song is cool for you as an American, but in Ukraine, we think it's like a Disney song. It's like, it's really lame. I was like,
Okay.
okay, so I'm gonna maybe I'll change this song. I'm glad that I learned this, So, there are a couple of things like this, but like for the most part, it was just like I had buy-in from them that like, after all this time we'd spent together, they saw it, they saw that what I had sort of promised and set out to do like came to fruition. They felt represented, and it was like the sort of green light to like start showing the film, or to finish the film essentially.
And I'm glad you started got on the topic of the music because Katya's work was I'd say captivating. I was gonna say great, but I needed to up it a bit. But then also some of the source music, and I couldn't tell what was what. But I think one of my favorite parts is after the performance, whatever that music was. I don't know if it was Katya or source music. It just it's like I will the soundtrack be released? Can we hear it?
Definitely. Yeah, I mean the soundtrack is amazing. I was gonna say that, we spent a lot of time. I probably listened to nothing but Ukrainian music for 2 years. And I have a pretty cool playlist that I put together of some pretty cool inspiration. But what's so amazing to me is like I was, we knew the film, it's a showcase of Ukrainian culture. It's like it's a recognition of the existence of something that's specifically Ukrainian, It's like these are things that are true. It's like maybe the war had started with this premise that there was no such thing as something separately Ukraine from Russia, that they're brother states, or that, it's sort of the denial of this existence. But like we watch in the film, it's the creation of something Ukrainian. And the music that's all of the music in the film, every single track is Ukrainian created. So
Excellent.
that includes Katya Richardson. She's a Ukrainian American who composed the score. So, we listen to this sort of wealth of music. It spans so many genres. It's such a vast sort of catalog of music and of eras. There's songs from that are there's songs that I met the musicians who are just like DIY, like they're just like cool artists, like trying to make some music in a warehouse, But then there's also like, there's music from the 50s. It was actually Soviet era Ukrainian music that, because it was created during the time of the Soviet Union, that those recordings are still owned. Like the masters are owned by the Russian state, the
Oh, no
Federation of
way.
Recordings.
That's
And
great.
so
I
they
mean, it's
have
great to
promises.
know, not that it's still under ownership, but yeah.
So it's fascinating, like, that's sort of a story of how sort of this like authoritarian nation is this nation is like sort of claimed ownership and restricted the sort of the even existence or representation of something Ukrainian. So we didn't license that song. We just put it in the film, and I am waiting for the lawsuit from the Kremlin. I don't know if it's gonna happen. I said I was like, probably nice press, if they're willing to sue us, we'll see if they will. So that, so there's all of this music, those tracks are used throughout the film. Then there's a significant amount of original music that Katya wrote, and that score is amazing and also spans all these genres. And I think that Katya is really impressive that she was able to sort of like navigate all of these different sounds and styles to try to like sort of express this like wealth of this variety of music. And I think that she really captures the feeling that people are going through. We talked a lot about dance as like the medium of the film. And why that's so important, because at war, it's like your body that's at stake. It's like, that when a bomb rips, let me just say this, it's like your body is the thing that's torn apart. So it's like, I think that the way that your body lives is like, that's the defiance. It's like the fact that you're alive is like in your body. And so we knew in the music, we wanted the sound of the song, the sound of this desire, the thing that's pulling them and compelling them to continue to create. It's like that sound had to come from the body. And so we have, there's like a motif, this vocalist, the sound of this singer. And I think that that's like, so amazing that Katya was able to sort of like get this and find a way to make it sort of tied all together in the film. And the album will come out on Spotify very soon. So there will be the original soundtrack, all the score will come out on Spotify, and then I think we'll probably make a playlist that includes all of the studio tracks that we also included in the film.
Excellent. I mean, you can't have peanut butter and jelly without the jelly, so I'm glad that you're putting what was into the movie as a supportive element that made the scene so impacting. And I hate to use the word regret. I don't think that that is the right, but I'm wondering, whenever I don't imagine that any documentary crew is like posh unless you're sponsored by Disney or David Attenborough. But you go in, try to get what you need, and only having those visits that you had in a year between, I'm sure that you wish you could have had more. But is there anything else that you're like, man, if we only we had this? And not to say it would have changed the outcome, but just you felt like it was essential, and you were just maybe you just cut a little short.
Yeah, there's a lot of I think that there's a lot of aspects of just normal life, live like having a normal life in a war zone that I feel like we weren't able to convey. So like there are little things like Dasha, who I find her to be a very important voice in the film, and she's not a big one. She only has a few things to say throughout the story, but they're very impactful to me. And she in her spare time, her day job is that she's just a barista. She's like doing a very normal, if you imagine like a Bushwick, like a Brooklyn kind of hipster dancer, who's like trying to dance and like kind of make ends meet and like also serving coffee and like, it's like this is the same person, it's like they would just be friends depending on which city they lived in. And so she's doing this, but like this is during the sirens and this is during like this time, and she's just trying to grind. And I feel like some of the sort of normalcy of like what life becomes when you still decide to be in a place where this is the danger. It's like this, I think that this are some of the pieces that I wish that we had more of. There were entire characters, there were participants of the film who interviewed with us, and we shot scenes with them, and we didn't end up being able to include them in the film because of the time that we had and the sort of structure that we were working within. And I think ultimately, maybe one thing that I find really important is there's this notion, there were people that decided that they could create, right? There were artists who sort of at a moment it occurred to them that they would continue this and that that was important to them. But that is not the normal. It's like, it's actually like, a lot of people have actually called us out on this when we post on social media. They're like, now make the same film in Gaza, like why aren't you talking about Gaza? And the fact is that this couldn't, I just don't think that this could exist in Gaza. I don't think that there's capacity in the same way that people would be able to like make a performance. Like a lot of people that the art doesn't exist. You go and you fight. Or like, art doesn't exist because you are just survival. It's like you can't like go make a dance performance if you're trying to find food. So like I think there's this sort of the like stark reality that I think, on one hand, I'm happy to make a film where like that stark reality isn't the overwhelming sensation. Like maybe it matters, I think, for us as an audience to just be reminded that like it's possible no matter what, that people are able to cling to a sense of purpose. And like that's the decision we made. Like the film is for this. It's like to remind us that like there is purpose. We can cling to it. But then there's this other reality that's like, I just think so much about the people who weren't able to make this decision.
Well, how do we use a good line from the movie to maybe wrap this up? It's a mouse job, little by little. And you made this yourself from beginning to end. So, I mean, I'm glad that it's going to be out in the world. I'm glad that people are going to get to partake it and kind of see what it is. And whether they take any message from it or just the fact that it's a different view at a different life, it's a lot to take in, but it's still an amazing effort. So here's another round of applause for you, Joe and team, everybody.
Thank you. And I have to I'd be remiss not to just share a little. If you don't mind, I just want to give a little plug, which is that,
Make it a big plug. Make it a big plug.
a big plug, which is
Yeah.
that we're self-distributing the film, and it's been a big fight to make the film. It's a big fight to show the film, and we just want to create this opportunity for people to get to experience it. And so we have a website, matchinahaystack.com, which is where we've been keeping all the screening information. There's still more screenings to come. There's a bunch on the East Coast coming up pretty soon. We have our Ukraine premiere coming soon. We have streaming dates that are nebulous, but the streaming is about to begin, so people will be able to see it in any place. We're still able to do screenings on requests. We have people reach out all the time to host some screenings, and we're really eager to support those requests and make it possible that people are able to see the film and together. I think that it's nice together. So I just wanted to say matchinahaystack.com is the best place to follow along as we're doing this. Or our Instagram, dangerouscompany.media. Or you can just email me, like my contact is there. It's like you'll email me, you'll get me, we'll talk about if we can show the movie together. It's like I would love to do this,
Well, Joe, we're going to put all that information in the post. But I think coming from you directly, that means a whole lot. People gravitate towards it. It's a tremendous experience, it's tremendous effort. It's all wrapped up in a bow, and it's honest. And I think that's the most important thing about a documentary. So, Joe Hill, thank you for your time. Everyone, check out Match in a Haystack, and we will catch you next time.